Hi, this is Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out the podcast of Connecting Faith. Programs like this are made possible through the financial support of listeners like you. You can find out more or make a gift by clicking on the Support Faith Radio tab on the homepage. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hello and welcome to today's program on Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem, and we're always happy to be able to connect to Dr. David Stevens. We do it from time to time, who is Chief Executive Officer of the Christian Medical and Dental Association, the nation's largest faith-based organization, doctors and the medical professionals. And our reason to connect today, of course, is to get some reaction and reflection and some perspective on the Supreme Court decision handed down late last week. Dr. Stevens, leading the Christian Medical Association and I think 16,500 or so doctors, want to get their perspective on this. And that opportunity for a lot of people to weigh in. We'll give you that opportunity on today's broadcast as well. You can join us. We'll open up the phone lines and just to get some of your reflection and comments. But we're interested particularly in just talking about this healthcare ruling and what it means, and particularly some implications for us. We also have some other health issues talk about. We'll get to that as we go on today's program. But Dr. Stevens, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Neil.
I always enjoy our times together, and I know that you've had a busy week, you and your entire staff, just sort of fielding questions and comments. So we'll add Faith Radio to the list. Give us a little summary of what you saw occurring with that decision last week.
Well, I think everyone was surprised. I think people on both sides of the issue were thinking that the Supreme Court would actually overturn the individual mandate. And people need to understand that individual mandate stating that everybody must have Obamacare-compliant insurance or pay a fine is kind of the linchpin. Without that, the whole thing was going to go falling apart. And then I think, secondly, they were surprised not the fact that the individual mandate was not overruled, but that Supreme Court Justice Roberts actually was the deciding vote. A lot of people thought if it went the other way, it would have been Kennedy. And, Roberts has pretty conservative, strict constructionist views of the Constitution. But he made that decision not based on the Commerce Clause, which is the main reasoning that the government brought to justify this, the fact that they had the right to regulate interstate commerce, but instead made his decision based on the fact that the government has the right to tax. And even though in the act it says that this is a penalty, you get a penalty if you do not get insurance, he said in reality that's a tax and the government has the right to tax and therefore this is constitutional. So I think a lot of people were caught by surprise, were scrambling very quickly and how they were going to comment on this. And, of course, a lot of things are going to flow out of this decision.
There was a sense, I guess, that by his decision or by the overall decision that it does sort of put the weight back on the American population, right, and the public in terms of our elected officials to say this is, you know, the Supreme Court's not going to be making all the laws. That's not their job.
Yeah, well, Roberts actually said, you know, it's not their job to decide whether it's wise or even whether it will work. Their only job was to decide whether it was constitutional. And it was kind of interesting how he put that because you almost could read through the lines, well, maybe he thinks it isn't wise. And whether he really meant that, I don't know. But, I mean, some people thought that might be the case. But, yes, this is probably elevated the whole Affordable Care Act to the same level, if not even higher, than the present economy as an election issue in November. And we're already seeing that in many things you're reading on the news in just the last few days.
You know, we've talked a lot about, I guess, some of the specifics, but there is, there are some big picture issues, and I guess we'd like to get a faith perspective on it as well. Give us a sense of, as you've looked at it, from representing your Christian medical professionals, how are you looking at this and the implications?
Yeah, well, first let me say Christian Medical Association doesn't have an official position on the Affordable Care Act. We do have some positions very much on some of the ethical pro-life issues and right of conscience issues and other things that are in there. But I think, about 85% of our members, from what we can tell, are opposed to the Affordable Care Act and some are for it. Those that are for it often are involved with care for the poor, working in urban centers, maybe perhaps in federally qualified clinics, and they see this as a way to help the patients that are uninsured, the working poor, that they see suffering. And I understand that, and that's a tremendous need. And we as Christians need to be concerned about those who can't get the health care they need. I think a lot of people like the fact this covers pre-existing conditions and, you can't lose your insurance because you get a serious illness and some of the other things that are in it that are very popular. But the big picture is this. We have passed something that we can't afford. And the biggest problem in health care is not the fact of access. The biggest problem in health care is the tremendous inflation in health care costs, which is going to bankrupt our country. And unfortunately, though it says the Affordable Care Act, this has nothing to do with limiting cost. In fact, the Affordable Care Act was estimated to cost close to $1 trillion over the first 10 years. Now the Congressional Budget Office has come out and said, no, it looks like it's going to cost $1.8 trillion, almost twice as much. The funds for this are actually coming from taking $500 billion from Medicare, which in itself is facing bankruptcy in the next 15 to 20 years based on projections. And here we're taking money out of that to pay for this. The other $500 billion is coming in new taxes, and the $800 billion that now they're estimating it's going to cost beyond that is not even funded. So essentially what we've done is gone out to people and giving them discounted tickets on the Titanic. In other words, you need to be on the healthcare ship. We're going to help supplement the cost of that so you can get on. But no one's paying attention that we're going right into the iceberg field, and this ship is going to go down if we don't do something. And what we've done is going to make it go down faster.
Now, in some ways, I mean, we're all of us are paying for costs anyway of those that don't have insurance, right? I mean, that through emergency room care. That's right. I mean, that there is. I guess, is this going to be any different, or are we just sort of leveling the field a little bit?
It's going to actually cost more. And, of course, getting your health care in the emergency room, which all emergency rooms are required by law to do, increases the cost of all of our insurance. It's estimated to be about $1,000 per policy that you're actually already paying. But there's so many new services and things that are now wrapped into the Affordable Care Act that really is not going to be a savings in the fact. Now, the other things that are being done, which need to be done, is how can we increase quality and by creating medical homes for people, better coordinating care, this type of thing, which I think has some potential and opportunity to really make difference in the quality of care, integration of care that people are getting. In other words, a team approach where you're not just seeing your private physician, but within that group, there's people that can help you with counseling, may help you as specialists, may help you, and they're all coordinating together to try to decrease costs. Unfortunately, that's very much in its infancy and is not going to make a big effect in the near future, and costs are going to increase, and we're already seeing that. The other thing I think people need to understand is, though it was promised everyone would be able to keep their own health care insurance, very few people is that actually going to be the case. And we had a good example of it, Neil, here at the Christian Medical Association. This year we had a 50% increase in premium from our insurance company. And we've been averaging 15-20% per year probably for the last 7 or 8 years. Those are unsustainable. Well, because of that increase, we had to go to a different carrier. We had to increase our copay. We had to increase our deductible. And that means we no longer qualify to keep our insurance when the exchanges come about, these state exchanges that are federally qualified in meeting the criteria. So automatically when those starts, we will have to put all our staff into that. And that's going to happen with the majority of healthcare plans across the country because all of them are going to have to change something as the years go by, and when they do, they go into the exchange system.
I assume if you don't keep your same insurance, then you potentially don't keep your same doctor then too, right?
That's very much the case. In fact, we changed insurance companies this year. I just got a letter last week that my doctor is no longer going to accept the insurance because this group doesn't pay as well, and so I'm losing my doctor over the exchange we made.
Which is something that was sort of a hallmark, I guess, of the act itself, wasn't it? That we would be able to maintain our existing practice, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You have that relationship with your local doctor. There's just, I think, one thing we all know for sure. There's going to be lots of changes that come, and this is not going to control cost in the long run. There's estimates it could make a difference in 10 or 15 years. Looking at Medicare, Medicaid, and what the promises were made and what actually happened, I seriously doubt that. We cannot add millions and millions of people to the healthcare rolls and think we're going to pay less for doing that.
Don't have to be math majors to probably be able to figure that out.
Well, it's not calculus.
we do want to talk a little bit about cost. In fact, coming up in a minute, I want to talk with Dr. David Stevens a little bit about what are some ways to cut costs. And I know that the word competition comes up from time to time. We'll get some perspective on that. Also want to talk about some of the faith perspective and, the conscience clauses, those kinds of things, and get an update on what's going on that side of things as well. Dr. David Stevens has joined us today. He's Chief Executive Officer of the Christian Medical and Dental Association, and they have some 16,500 doctors they represent. And we're talking today about healthcare, getting some reflection, reaction, and some perspective. I invite you to join with us here on Faith Radio. You can call the show at 877-93-FAITH. It's 877-933-2484, and we'll continue in a minute. Seventeen past the hour. Happy to have back with us today on the Connecting Faith, Dr. David Stevens from Christian Medical and Dental Association. Dr. Stevens, Chief Executive Officer of that ministry. Prior to his service with the CMDA, he served as Medical Director of Samaritan's Purse, and he has several roles as well, serving as Fellow of the Biotechnology Policy Council, the Wilberforce Forum, and is talking to us today from their offices in Tennessee. And David, I just want to talk a little bit about competition, I guess, because that's one of the areas that when we think about cost reduction, is that as much a solution as anything? Or are there some other ways that, I guess, in terms of us encouraging our elected officials about cost containment, what are the solutions?
Well, cost is the key. The reason people don't have insurance is not because they don't want it, the vast majority of it, it's because they can't afford it. And a good example of that is in the Affordable Care Act, because they're actually going to be supplementing insurance costs for people up to making $92,000 a year. So, I know our cost even here at CMDA is $12,000 to $14,000 per family to cover their insurance. So these are issues. So how do we get it down? Increased competition. Right now, insurance is sold on a state-by-state basis and regulated. So there's no competition across state lines. That would help. One of the biggest issues is the marked increase in bureaucracy. In fact, the New England Journal of Medicine just had an article within the last month talking about that, estimating that 30%, one out of every $3 spent on health care, is because of the bureaucracy we've created. And you can see that. I saw an interesting figure the other day. In the 50s, it was about $8 billion for health care in the United States. Based on inflation and all those things, the cost today should be around $80 billion. Instead, it's $2.5 trillion. And that's because we have created this bureaucracy. When I was a child, Neil, you were as well, you went to the doctor, there was a receptionist, a nurse in the back, and the physician. And now there's a dozen people in the back trying to file insurance, deal with Medicare, Medicaid, a half a dozen or more insurance companies. We've created enormous bureaucracy. We need tort reform, not just because of the cost of malpractice suits, but because of defensive medicine. Doctors order tests all the time. They don't need to protect themselves from suits. And we need a good malpractice reform where, yes, real malpractice can still bring financial rewards to people that have been hurt, but not all these nuisance suits and all this defensive medicine, which cost us a lot of money.
This seems like that, too. Even just those two in terms of competition and tort reform are such a massive sea change that you wonder how that could actually take place. Does it have to happen just maybe in bite-sized pieces?
Well, it does, and you've got to attack it. We've had some states that have done tort reform, for example, and seen a marked increase in malpractice costs, suits, and what is being ordered. It's going to take a while to change the culture of medicine. But not only that, there's waste. There's stuff that's just ordered that's not needed. We went to a healthcare savings account system here at CMDA a number of years ago where we actually give our employees a certain amount of money each year in their healthcare savings account. There's a small gap between that and when the insurance kicks in, which comes out of their personal pocket. But it changed their behavior. It changed my behavior. I go to the doctor and he orders something and I say, what difference is that really going to make in my care? Because I'm spending my money now, not some insurance company's money. And that's what we do when we buy everything else we buy. We decide, you know, I've got a postage stamp yard. I don't need a riding lawnmower to do a postage stamp size yard to mow it. And the same is true in healthcare. Is this going to make a difference in my treatment? Is this going to make a difference in my future, the fact that I am getting this more expensive medicine? We can do some simple things like this, Neil. When I was back in residency, I did a revolutionary research project my third year. At least I thought it was. I actually told the residents what stuff they ordered cost. 'Cause we had no idea what that x-ray or that laboratory cost, and we saw the decreased cost of health care about from what the residents were ordered. Well, you know, we have all this electronic medical records now that are being implemented across the country. They don't tell the doctor anything about cost. When I order this, I don't know what it costs. Well, let's just put that on there and say, here's a cheaper alternative. Here's a way to save money. We've got to look at this as not a right of health care. We need to look at this as a privilege of health care that we need to pay for, and let's get value for what we're spending.
Is there maybe an inverse proportion where we tend to go less to our own detriment? I was thinking, on HSA as well, and say, well, I should get this checked out. But it's like, well, that's going to cost me. So, do we get to that point where we're not taking as good care of ourselves?
People talk about that all the time, and I have not seen a lot of it happening. I'm sure it could happen in certain occurrences. People have a real desire to protect themselves and protect their health. And, of course, you can make a mistake and think it's not something significant and not spend the money. But the other side of the coin is that people go to the doctor for almost no reason at all, for things that really don't need a physician's treatment. They get expensive medicines. We get antibiotic resistance because of all the things we're ordering. The more you go, the more that will be done. It's just the matter of the way medicine works. And so, yes, I think it's wise to think, you know, do I feel that bad with this flu that I really need to go to the physician? Is it going to be worth me spending the money on? That's probably a good thought to have.
Let's talk a little bit about Medicare and Medicaid, because this is a key part of the reform and a big issue. I mean, we are going to get to some of those issues of conscience and other things as well. But let's touch a little bit on that. Is there room to do some reforming there? And from your perspective, what would that look like?
Well, there is the need for reform, and entitlement programs have their issues with them, and part of it is what we've already talked about, and the fact that this doesn't cost me anything, so I'll go and access it. I still remember, and it's been 30 years ago, in residency, I'd just come back from spending a month overseas working in a mission hospital and was on call, and 2 o'clock in the morning, a Medicaid mom came in. Single mom with her 2-year-old, and he wasn't very sick. In fact, he wasn't sick at all. He had a cold for like a week, and I turned to her and I said, you know, got me out of bed at 2 o'clock in the morning, which I wasn't very happy about it. I said, you know, this child really isn't very sick. why did you bring him in at 2 o'clock in the morning? And she looked at me and said, well, you know, Johnny Carson was just going off, and I didn't want this baby to keep me up again another night. And that type of attitude with our entitlement programs, we do want to help the poor, but we have not structured them well with some sort of copay, some sort of buy-in that this actually costs me something, leads to abuse and leads to people not perhaps following medical advice because they have no buy-in or even taking their medicines as they're prescribed. And so I don't mean that to sound harsh, but we hear a lot about social justice. And, you know, if I'd given that woman justice, it probably wouldn't have been a pretty sight that night. What I gave her was mercy. That's what the Bible tells us to do, to love people even when they may not be doing loving things. But I think there also has to be accountability in the systems and in Medicare and Medicaid, enough buy-in that people look at this and realize they're spending some of their own money and they need to be good stewards of what's being given to them.
I'm curious, you know, you've spent some time overseas working with the Samaritan's Purse. You've done short-term missions trips, and just as you were talking about, have we exported that kind of buy-in in our medical ideas, and particularly, I mean, so much of it's mission hospital-based, I guess, but have we done it right overseas compared to where we could have done it right here?
Well, I think mission hospitals have done vastly better than government programs that we've exported overseas. And we've learned in community health, community development, that there has to be local ownership or real behavior changes don't occur. You know, the estimate now, Neil, in this country is 70% of our illnesses are self-inflicted. We go overseas and people's illnesses are self-inflicted because they don't have clean water, they don't have immunizations, they don't, you know, they a lot of other things and behaviors that lead to problems. Well, we have the same problems here. They're just different. It's not clean water. It's obesity. It's not good sanitation. It's the fact that, you know, we take too much salt in our diet. We don't control our blood pressures. We don't get enough exercise. And so much of what we're dealing with in the enormous costs for diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, renal disease, much of that is self-inflicted. So I think one of the things that has to happen in this country is that we need to take responsibility more for our own health and live healthier lives. And I think the people that should be leading that are Christians, because the Bible teaches us about stewardship of the gifts God has given to us. And for each one of us, that's our life and that's our health.
Well, and of course, you know, Dr. Stevens, that you know, we don't come up very high on that scale sometimes. We like our church potlucks too much or something, maybe.
Well, we always say we've got the best medical system in the world. That's not really true. We may have technology that's great, but the United States rates 37th in the world on the level of health of its population.
That's kind of astounding.
It is astounding, and most people don't realize it, and most of it is because of what I just said, the fact that we do not live healthy. I was in Australia, and I was down there doing some speaking, and I tell you, I think everybody in that country is out exercising every morning. I mean, I went for a walk, and it was like the multitudes had gathered, running up and down the beaches, running on the sidewalks, running up the mountains. Everybody is into health, and you see that it's a culture. And unfortunately, we don't have that here, and we're paying the price in our healthcare system.
And there have been efforts overall to try and change that, but are we making any progress in that? I mean, I guess if you were to give us a health grade, 37th in the world, that sounds like more like
that
D.
That sounds like a D minus,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
Wow.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, knowledge doesn't change behavior. I learned this doing community health work in Kenya. We all know a lot of things we should do and we don't do them. And it's accountability, it's motivation, it's incentives to get people to do things. Here at CMDA, just recently, we combined the federal required 10-minute break in the morning, 10 minutes in the afternoon, added another 10 minutes, and encouraged everybody to take 30 minutes during the workday to go exercise. Because we need to incentivize people and make it easy for them to take good care of themselves and be good stewards of what God has given them. And I think we need to think more like that in our own lives and the lives of those people that we may influence.
All right, I'm going to take 2 minutes and do a little exercise and a stretch while we While we get ready for our second half of today's programs, we talked to Dr. David Stevens, who's the CEO of Christian Medical and Dental Association. They're serving 16,500 doctors and medical professionals, and we'll talk a little bit more about CMDA in the next half of the program. We also want to talk about some of the faith-based and pro-life issues that are related to the healthcare discussion that's going on today. And we'd welcome your calls as well. If you'd like to join in, it's 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484, or you can check us out online, faithradionet.com. And then click on the Connecting Faith show page for an email link. We'll continue in 2 minutes. Stay tuned. Thanks for connecting with us. 32 past the hour. I'm Neil Stavem, and my guest today, Dr. David Stevens, who has joined us. He's the CEO of the Christian Medical and Dental Association, and we're getting some perspective on the recent Supreme Court decision on health care, and that gave us an opportunity just to talk a little bit about health care and in our country. And we want to take your questions. We'll get to a couple of those in a moment. But, David, one of the areas that we haven't talked about yet is the area of conscience, and I think particularly pro-life things. We've heard, obviously, about the HHS assuming that we will just that abortion will and abortion pills will be provided. Talk about what's going on there and where you see the direction that headed.
Well, what most people don't realize is the Affordable Care Act gave tremendous power to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and the HHS contraceptive mandate is kind of the first volley of that. What they did was went to the Institute of Medicine, put together a special committee to recommend what preventive measures they should fund. They stacked that committee with people involved with Planned Parenthood, NIREL, other abortion providers. Even during those discussions, they wish they could have included abortion as a preventative measure. But what they did, and surgical abortion, what they did was say that all insurance plans in the United States must cover with no copays, no deductibles, all FDA-approved contraceptives. Now, many people know that some contraceptives work like contraceptives. They prevent pregnancy, but there are others that work by actually interrupting or could interrupt a already established pregnancy. Probably the one that's the clearest is Ella, which is related to the abortion pill RU486 and works exactly in the same manner and is now being used as a contraceptive, so-called contraceptive. This directly impinges on religious freedom because they gave a conscience clause that was the most restrictive that's ever been put into federal law. It essentially limits conscience protections to only churches, not to Christian ministries, not to hospitals, not to Jesus Christ and the disciples, not to Mother Teresa and the nuns. No one else qualifies. You have to be actually teaching faith practices, teaching theology. You have to have the vast majority of your employees share your religious beliefs, and you must only be providing your services to people that agree with your religious beliefs. So this especially got the Catholic Church upset, of course, with their stand on contraceptives. But it is a direct attack on religious freedom in the United States. It's going to affect every one of us, because if this type of restrictive view of conscience stands, it's going to change our religious freedom as we know it across this country.
And we spend a lot of time debating health care and the issues of costs and access. Those things come up. But this is is another aspect which doesn't get a lot of press. I mean, the whole area of religious freedom, it is a profound one, isn't it?
It is more important in the long run than how we're going to pay for health care, that's for sure. Because what's happening, Neil, is this. We're moving away from a freedom of religion protection to the government saying, no, all we need to do is protect your freedom to worship. In other words, let's keep your religious freedom inside your synagogue, your mosque, your church, and whatever you want to do in there, that's fine. But it cannot affect your behavior outside that area. And this is freedom of worship like you want. But as far as religious practice, well, no, you have to do what we tell you have to do.
Where do you see that going? In the is there enough energy and, I guess, angst about that, to see some changes taking place?
Well, I've never seen the Roman Catholic Church upset as they are right now. And actually, they're having 2 weeks of focus on religious freedom right now across the country through the 4th of July with special rallies. We had a rally here locally in the Tri-City area of Tennessee. And I think we as Protestants should be out there with them. This isn't a Catholic issue. This is a religious freedom issue that's going to affect all of us. The Catholic Church, through the Beckett Fund, kind of like the Alliance Defense Fund that works with the Catholic Church, has 22 suits that they've brought with 56 plaintiffs in a variety of courts across the country challenging this. There is political pressure being brought to bear on HHS. Unfortunately, even with all this furor, the administration came back and said, well, we're going to give you an extra year to comply. It was supposed to start August 1st this year, as if, well, after a year, you're not going to have your conscience anymore. I mean, that's ridiculous. So this is a battle we dare not lose, and it's a battle we need to keep people informed about. I encourage people that are concerned about right of conscience. We have a website that we put up that represents 50 different organizations called Freedom Number 2 Care, all one word, freedomtocare.org. And you can go on there and be kept up to date. They'll Twitter you, Facebook you, and give you an opportunity to speak out very easily to your congressmen and senators. But we all need to really step up to the plate on this one, or life as we know it, as far as our religious practices and our freedoms, is going to change tremendously.
I know I've heard you say it in the past, too, that many of the members of CMDA say, you know, I will give up my practice if it comes to having to give up my strong held beliefs.
Well, there's tremendous pressure on healthcare professionals, and our traditional issue has been healthcare right of conscience, because we're seeing that there is no enforceable protection for healthcare professionals. 95% of them said they quit medicine before they violated their conscience. 2 out of 5 have said they know of someone who has been pressured. 1 out of 4 say they've been pressured and lost a job, have been discriminated against in promotion, have lost an educational opportunity. This is a big issue in healthcare, trying to force people to do things they don't want to do on ethical issues. I have a staff member whose wife's a family practice doctor, and practicing in Texas family practice, didn't want to give contraceptives to unmarried girls. And she just referred them across the hallway to a colleague. And her employer, a medical school there, actually found out about it and told her she had 1 week to change her behavior, or they would work hard to make sure she lost her license and they would fire her. An anesthesiologist down in North Carolina who was pressured to provide anesthesia for an elective abortion. When he refused, they threatened him with his job. The stories just go on. And right of conscience and religious freedom, I think, is the most important issue that we as Christians need to be involved in. Because if we don't deal with this one, we're Christian healthcare professionals are not going to be in the forefront of fighting against abortion, euthanasia, you know, your best safeguard against some of the things happening in bioethics and healthcare is to have a person who shares your religious worldview providing your care and protecting you.
Well, let's talk about some ways that there have been groups that have been forming that would provide care and maybe for a better price and maybe around a set of values. Sally from Minneapolis asks, I don't have health insurance. I could be on my husband's health plan, but it's more expensive. So what do you think of MediShare and those kinds of programs?
I think they've matured a lot. Some of them have been under attack from state regulators. In certain states, they aren't able to sell their products in. And I think the concept is very biblical. We have not gone to that step yet. We may at some point. You know, and I have not been on the inside of them to know, as someone who's actually helping to share medical costs, what the impact of that is financially and what the impact of that is as far as helping meet my health care costs. It's not like you pay a premium and you get a benefit. It's they let you know what the health care costs are for people in the plan, and then people donate. And that way it's not a direct form of insurance, and they are outside insurance regulations. But I like the concept that we as Christians have the responsibility to help others.
Do you see more of that or less of that, maybe in light of our current healthcare direction?
Well, if with under the Affordable Care Act, if an employee refuses coverage from their through insurance, they can be charged the whole cost of the plan or 1, 2, or 2.5% of their annual salary, whichever is greater. That's what the law says. So how that's going to be interpreted with these Medishare type plans, I don't know. Employers even have it worse. If you don't put a plan in place that's compliant with federal regulations, they charge you $100 per employee per day. With our staff here, and we don't have a huge staff, that would be $3.6 million a year for us. So there are some really enormous penalties for not, and plus you can be sued as an employer. But if you decide to give up your health care plan, you only have to pay $2,000 a year per employee and that is, 20% less, 15% of what we're paying for health care. So the move is going to be get employers to cut their health care plans and move people into the state exchanges because it's going to be much cheaper for them.
Well, Angie sends a note in on faithradionet.com, and you can go to the Connecting Faith show page. Got the link there, faithradionet.com, and then click on Connecting Faith. She says, how can the government not see that the ACA is a bad idea, doesn't address the real problem? Well, that's a good question. Also, why don't members of the federal government have to get health care the same way the rest of the country does? And then finally, I've heard reporters say that the ACA will provide insurance for the majority of the uninsured in our country. Is that the case? If people can't afford health insurance, does the act actually provide insurance at a lower or no cost?
The actual coverage is going to take about half of those that are uninsured and cover them, not all of them by any means. And so that may be the next target after that. This isn't the total bill we may need to pay. As far as Congress being on the same insurance plan or lack of it that other people have, that's never happened, and I'm not looking forward to the day when it will. They have a pretty great program as far as their insurance coverage. I think this has been a very populist move. I mean, it's very politically attractive to segments of the population that are not able to afford insurance to get it, and for very little or for nothing. And that we call that populist because that actually garners votes and support for those proposing this. But unfortunately, I think, almost like a Ponzi scheme, sooner or later, there are not enough people to pay for what we've promised. And when that happens, then the whole thing collapses. And that's when we end up with the problems we're already projecting in Social Security, Medicaid, because we're not paying the bills. And we have taken the life of over 50 million taxpayers who were going to help support Social Security and Medicare, and now we're going to pay the piper because there's not enough people to pay enough taxes to support what we've created.
And we never really talk about that when we talk about abortion, do we, about the long-term implications, not just to the families and that have been changed forever, but that's a real economic effect. And we're going to talk more. We'll, in fact, mention there's a couple of abortion updates. We want to get to that with Dr. David Stevens, and we're talking health care today. You're welcome to join the conversation at 877-933-2484. Or, again, you can go online, faithradionet.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith Show page and send us an email that way. We'll get it right into the studio and happy to take your questions today. Dr. David Stevens, Chief Executive Officer of the Christian Medical and Dental Association, is with us today on Connecting Faith. Six past the hour, and we're talking today, Dr. David Stevens, Chief Executive Officer of the Christian Medical and Dental Association, the nation's largest faith-based organization of doctors. He's a spokesman for over 16,500, I think, at last report. David, it's a big group of people that are making a big difference in our nation.
Well, we actually work on 242 medical and dental school campuses with students, almost like an intervarsity or navigators for students in medical and dental school. And I want to encourage people. You know, we talked a lot of things that are not positive, but God is at work in Christian students' lives. There's a lot of Christian doctors coming out. I just came back this weekend from a residency program, Christian Family Practice Residency Program, that's celebrating 30 years and have sent out hundreds of dedicated Christian doctors. God's still at work, and it's no time to be in despair. God's in control. There's five new Christian medical schools, the first ones in the country in years, that are underway right now and start up. God is, you know, creating some alternatives. And if people are trying to find Christian doctors, they can go to our website, cmda.org, and find a list of Christian doctors in their area, specialists they're looking for. A lot of other resources there on ethical issues to help educate them. We're to be salt and light during these difficult times. And one of the things is not to despair. We've got hope, and we know the end of the story. Yes, we are righteous voices in love to our culture, speaking the truth. But at the same time, we do not have to feel like the world is ending because the Affordable Care Act is passed if you're opposed to it, or that we have created heaven on earth if you are for it and not opposed to it. But realize that our hope is in Jesus Christ.
And there is perhaps no stronger way to communicate the love and compassion than as we care for those in physical need, right?
Well, and the amazing thing to me, there's just an enormous renaissance, Neil, in interest in medical missions. We're seeing this on campuses. We have our Global Mission Health Conference in Louisville each year. There's 2,500 to 3,000 people coming to that. We have 1,300 students and residents who have come to us and said, mentor me during my training because my goal, my plan, my call is to go into career missions. And I think God is raising up a generation of Christian healthcare professionals to finish the Great Commission. I think the key to getting into the 1040 window in those difficult-to-access countries are Christian healthcare professionals. And we're seeing an interest, a response, an excitement like I don't think's happened since right after World War II and maybe not in the last 100 years.
Mm. That's good news. David, let's say a word about there's a decision, a court decision, I guess, stayed a plan to increase qualifications, I guess we put that one, Mississippi ruling. I just saw something in the paper today. They wanted doctors to actually be qualified, right?
Yeah, there's a dirty little secret a lot of people don't know about the abortion industry, is that most of the doctors that do this routinely, and there's only about 2,200 in the United States, make an enormous amount of money doing abortions, but most of them are not doctors that other doctors admire. Is that a good way to put it? There are people that often have had trouble in their medical careers, may have come out and can't get a job, and they end up doing abortions. And what's happened in Louisiana or in Mississippi is that they have said, if you work in an abortion clinic as a doctor, you must have admitting privileges in a nearby hospital, so if there are complications, you can take care of them. The other dirty little secret is that abortionists do not take care of their mistakes, and their patients just end up going to the emergency room. They aren't on call at night. They don't follow up like other doctors do if there's a complication or a problem. And Mississippi said, listen, you've got to be able to take and follow up your patients like every other doctor. We're requiring you to have hospital admission privileges. Well, there's only one abortion clinic in the state. There's three doctors there, and none of them have admission privileges. So unless they change what they're doing, there will be no abortion clinics in Mississippi.
And hence the court said no on that one.
And they said no on that one, at least temporarily. But I think they're going to have a hard time trying to find a constitutional reason that you can't have doctors take care of the complications that they create with their surgeries.
Sure. Take a call here. Rick in Wappan, Wisconsin, has a question about non-entitlement. Rick, go ahead. You're on with Dr. David Stevens.
Thank you for taking my question. My question is, my wife works part-time for a medical facility, and she's as a receptionist will sometimes ask for the $2 copay, whether it's Medicare or Medicaid, and she has sometimes been chastised by her organization for asking for that. So how can we as a people get people beyond the entitlement thing if you have an organization that isn't even going to ask them to pay that few dollars that they have to pay for this? And I really believe with what you said, an entitlement, Because if we don't own a responsibility into it, we never accept cost for it, and we say, who cares? Somebody else is paying it.
Yeah. And we lose the sense of personal responsibility affects our whole culture. And I know you've heard probably, Stacey, I heard that, you know, 50% of people in the United States no longer pay any taxes. And so if you're not actually got any skin in the game, then it's just a matter of give me, give me, give me. And that's not healthy for children. It's not healthy for our culture. It's not healthy for our country. And I think what we have to do is just to be hold people accountable, organizations accountable, and increase the skin in the game. You know, my children all work in the inner city. They work with poor. They work with Medicare, Medicaid patients, refugees, and a healthcare ministry. But they would be the first ones to say that, yes, there needs to be some responsibility, some cost based on ability that people need to contribute so that they'll value what they're receiving.
There was a report out the other day that said white Protestants heavily favored the overturning of the Health Care Act. African American Protestants, it was sort of the other way around. And I'm thinking, you know, we can easily be pictured as uncaring or lacking compassion as evangelicals. How do we make sure that we are caring for the poor, the needy, maybe illegals, whatever it might be?
Well, I think we have to demonstrate that with our lives, and that's in our local communities and care. You know, I get challenged to this. You know, don't you believe in social justice? And, you know, and I can say, hey, listen, I spent 11 years on the mission field. I've gone into war zones. I take care of the poor. I go on mission trips. I help people in the community. Our church does things. You know, we need to be out there in front demonstrating love because people will want to caricaturize us as uncaring, and that is not the point. Unfortunately, what has happened, I think, in the last two or three generations is as the government has taken more and more and over, the church has stepped further and further back. And though there are a lot of hospitals still called Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, or whatever, many of them are in the business of medicine, not the charities that they were originally designed to be. And we need to reclaim that mantle personally and corporately in our churches to reach out to the poor.
So what would your challenge be to your members who are, you know, 16,000 plus strong, and, you know, those of us listening that are maybe involved in the medical profession so that it doesn't become just a business? So what's your challenge today?
Well, one of the great concerns I have with this is the deprofessionalization of medicine. Medicine becomes a business. It's not a covenant relationship with patients. It's a contract. It's the business model. You're a provider. All these things are slipping in, and we're resisting that and encouraging our members to. And then secondly, to give themselves. We're just starting a new program for dentists saying give a half day a week in your practice to take care of the uninsured and do that in your practice. So we're helping to start clinics across the United States. In urban areas to reach the poor. We're challenging our doctors, if they're not working in those clinics, then give time in your practice to the poor. It's not enough just to go on mission trips overseas. You need to take care of people on your own doorstep and show them the love of Jesus Christ. And the best way to do that, and people sometimes say, well, it's too costly and I've got overhead. Well, God didn't say that giving to the poor was not going to cost you anything. It always does. It costs you time. It costs you money. But the Good Samaritan did it right. He said, he reached in his pocket and said, yes, I will care for this one. And we need to do the same.
Well, and I guess not just as medical professionals, but all of us, right? I
mean, absolutely.
We can't just say, well, we'll wait for the doctor to take care of that.
No, absolutely. And I think the church, especially with the sick and dying, we have a tradition and we do it in our churches of rallying around people that are ill and dying in our church. But churches need to do that in their communities and reach out beyond their own borders and perhaps hold open church-based clinics or do preventive care in their community and teaching and training. There's a lot of things you can do without being a healthcare professional to help meet the healthcare needs of those in need.
Well, David, it's always good to visit with you, and I know we've mentioned the website, cmda.org. That's the main website. The other one, if you're interested particularly in right of conscience issues, is freedom2care.org. That's freedom, the number 2care.org. And, David, that's you said, what, some 50 organizations there. Just that's kind of a good catch-all place to find out what's going on in this fight.
It's a clearing house, yeah, on everything happening on Right of Conscience.
Yeah, good. And anything else in terms of what we'll find on CMDA on that website?
There's lots of information, including meetings and retreats and books, resources. And one of the things people really like, there's a set of resources that you can put up on your church website on all the major ethical issues, free download. And just go there and you'll see it listed. And it's a great way to inform people in your church about euthanasia and abortion, embryonic stem cell research, all the issues that we're facing in science and healthcare.
A number of areas where we have to be praying about, too, it seems like, not just talking about.
Oh, absolutely. I think prayer is the key. And for ourselves, that we don't despair, that we realize God's in control. And secondly, pray that God's will be done as we move forward so our country may prosper and continue to have its effect around the world, especially with our mission outreaches and church outreaches that have so affected the whole world around us.
David, thank you for your generosity taking some time today. It's always good to get caught up, and we appreciate your leadership with the CMDA.
Neil, it's a joy to be with you. God bless you for what you do.
Dr. David Stevens on with us today, Chief Executive Officer of the Christian Medical and Dental Association, the nation's largest faith-based organization of doctors, some 16,500 in the fold there. And you can find out more online at cmda.org, or, again, if you're interested in pursuing some of the issues of right of conscience, that's freedomtocare.org. And coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk a little bit about freedom, about financial freedom. L.E.K. returns to Connecting Faith. In time for the 4th of July, we'll think about freedom. The issues that we deal with in finances are important to our freedom as well, and we'll get to that tomorrow here on Connecting Faith. Live the Promise today. Susie Larson talks with author Josh Weidman about the book Honest to God.